Let me welcome everyone to the Ethnic and Racial Studies LSE public lecture tonight. This is the school's final public lecture of the academic year. We're very honoured to have our speaker this evening, Professor William Julius Wilson of Harvard University, one of America's most distinguished social scientists. He is currently distinguished visiting professor in the SRC Center for the Analysis of Social Exclusion, otherwise known as CASE, here at the school. Professor Wilson is Lewis and Linda Geiser University Professor at Harvard University, Harvard's highest distinction of a star attached to his professorship, where he is a member of the Kennedy School of Government. Before moving to Harvard in 1996, he was for 24 years, as many people here will know, Professor of Sociology at the University of Chicago, where he directed the Center for the Study of Urban Inequality. William Wilson is best known as a writer and commentator on race, urban poverty, and African-American social and economic conditions. He is the author of the best-selling, prize-winning works such as The Declining Significance of Race, a very famous book, The Truly Disadvantaged, and most recently, almost or perhaps as famous, When Work Disappears. William Wilson is not only a distinguished scholar, but a leading commentator on American social conditions. He was selected by Time magazine as one of America's 25 most influential people in 1996. He's also been an advisor on race and urban issues to President Clinton. He is a member of the US National Academy of Sciences and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's been a member of the board of the co-sponsor of this lecture, the academic journal, Ethnic and Racial Studies, since its foundation 20 years ago this year. We're delighted to welcome Professor Wilson to the school, and I now invite him to lecture to the title, When Work Disappears, New Implications for Race and Urban Poverty in the Global Economy. Professor Wilson.
Thank you very much. It is indeed a pleasure to return to the London School of Economics and to have the opportunity to address you on an issue that I care deeply about. The decreased relative demand for low-skilled labor and its implications for the urban poor and race relations. Now, in drawing these issues out, I want to, in the first part of my lecture, highlight some of the main arguments raised in my latest book, When Work Disappears. And then, in the second part of my lecture, I want to discuss how to shape the policy debate so that the problems of the low-skilled labor force are not isolated and treated as minority or poverty issues in countries like the United States and Britain. So let me begin. There is a new poverty in American metropolises that has consequences for a range of issues relating to the quality of life in urban areas, including race relations. By the new urban poverty, I mean poor, segregated neighborhoods in which a majority of individual adults are either unemployed or have dropped or never been dropped out of or never been part of the labor force. This jobless poverty stands in sharp contrast to previous periods. For example, in 1950, a substantial portion of the urban black population was poor, but they were working. Urban poverty was quite extensive, but people held jobs. However, as we entered the 1990s, most poor adults were not working in a typical week in the ghetto neighborhoods of America's larger cities. For example, in 1950, a significant majority of adults held jobs in a typical week in the three neighborhoods that represent the historic core of the Black Belt in Chicago: Douglas, Grand Boulevard, and Washington Park. These are the neighborhoods that received a large share of the migrants from the South during the first half of the 20th century. But by 1990, only 4 in 10 adults worked in Douglas, 1 in 3 in Washington Park, and 1 in 4 in Grand Boulevard. When you think of urban joblessness in the States, particularly inner city joblessness, you think of black males because they have such a high jobless rate. Well, in 1950, almost 70%, 69.5% of all males 14 and over held a job in a typical week in these three neighborhoods. By 1960, 60% of such a group was so employed. But by 1990, only 37% of all males 16 and over held a job in a typical week in these three neighborhoods. The disappearance of work has adversely affected not only individuals and families, but the social life of neighborhoods as well. Inner city joblessness in America is a severe problem that is often overlooked or obscured when the focus is mainly on poverty and its consequences. Because despite increases in the concentration of poverty since 1970, inner cities in the United States have always featured high levels of poverty. But the current levels, the levels of inner city joblessness reached during the first half of the 1990s was unprecedented. And I should note that when I speak of joblessness, I'm not solely referring to official unemployment. The unemployment rate, as measured in the United States, represents only the percentage of workers in the official labor force. That is those who are actively looking for work. It does not include those who are outside of the labor force or have never been a part of the labor market, including the nearly 6 million males, 25 to 60 years of age, who appeared in the census statistics but were not recorded in the labor market statistics in 1990. And these uncounted males in the labor market are disproportionately represented in the inner city ghettos. Accordingly, in my book, When Work Disappears, I use what I consider to be a more appropriate measure of joblessness, a measure that takes into account both official unemployment and non-labor force participation. And that measure is the employment to population ratio, which corresponds to the percentage of adults 16 and over who are working. And using the employment to population ratio, we find, for example, that in 1990, only 1 in 3 adults ages 16 and over held a job in the ghetto poverty areas of Chicago, areas representing roughly 425,000 men, women, and children. And in the ghetto neighborhoods of the nation's 100 largest cities, for every 10 adults who did not hold a job in a typical week in 1990, there were only 6 employed persons. The consequences of high neighborhood joblessness are more devastating than those of high neighborhood poverty. A neighborhood in which people are poor but employed is much different from a neighborhood in which people are poor and jobless. So when work disappears, I attempt to show that many of today's problems in America's inner city ghetto neighborhoods, crime, family dissolution, welfare, low levels of social organization, and so on, are in major measure related to the disappearance of work. Now, it should be clear that when I speak of the disappearance of work, I am referring to the declining involvement in or lack of attachment to the formal labor market. Because it could be argued that in the general sense of the term, joblessness does not necessarily mean non-work. In other words, to be officially unemployed or officially outside the labor market does not mean that one is totally removed from all forms of work activity. Many people who are officially joblessness are nonetheless involved in informal kinds of work activity, ranging from unpaid housework to work in the informal or illegal economies that draw income. After all, housework is work, babysitting is work, even drug dealing is work. However, what contrasts work in the formal economy with work activity in the informal and illegal economies is that work in the formal economy is characterized by, indeed calls for, greater regularity and consistency in schedules and hours. Work schedules and hours are formalized. The demands for discipline are greater. Now, it's true that some work activities outside the formal economy also call for discipline and regular schedules. Several studies reveal, for example, that the social organization of the drug industry in the United States is driven by discipline and a work ethic, however perverse. But as a general rule, work in the informal and illegal economies is far less governed by norms or expectations that place a premium on discipline and regularity. So for all these reasons, when I speak of the disappearance of work, I mean work in the formal economy, work that provides a framework for daily behavior because of the discipline, regularity, and stability that work imposes. You see, in the absence of regular employment, a person lacks not only a place in which to work and the receipt of regular income, but also a coherent organization of the present. That is, a system of concrete expectations and goals. Regular employment provides the anchor for the spatial and temporal aspects of daily life. It determines where you're going to be and when you are going to be there. In the absence of regular employment, life, including family life, becomes less coherent. Persistent unemployment and irregular employment hinder rational planning and daily life, a necessary condition of adaptation to an industrial economy. So a youngster who grows up in a family with a steady breadwinner and in a neighborhood in which most of the adults are employed will tend to develop automatically some of the discipline habits associated with steady or stable employment. Habits that are reflected in the behavior of his or her parents and of other neighborhood adults. These might include attachment to a routine, a recognition of the hierarchy found in most work situations, a sense of personal efficacy attained through the routine management of financial affairs, endorsement of a system of personal and material rewards associated with dependability and responsibility, and so on. Accordingly, when this youngster enters the labor market, he or she has a distinct advantage over the youngsters who grow up in households without a steady breadwinner and in neighborhoods that are not organized around work. In other words, a milieu in which one is more exposed to the less disciplined habits associated with casual or infrequent work. And with the sharp recent rise of solo parent families in the United States, Black children who live in inner city households are less likely to be socialized in a work environment for two main reasons. Their mothers, saddled with child care responsibilities, can prevent a slide deeper into poverty by accepting welfare. Their fathers, removed from family responsibilities and obligations, are more likely to become idle as a response to restricted employment opportunities, which further weakens their influence on the household and attenuates their contact with the family. In short, the social and cultural responses to limiting constraints and changing norms are reflected in the organization of family life and patterns of family formation. There they have implications for labor force attachment as well. Now, what accounts for the much higher proportion of jobless adults in America's inner cities since the mid-20th century? An easy explanation would be racial segregation. However, a race-specific argument is not sufficient to explain recent changes in such neighborhoods. After all, the historic Black Belt neighborhoods that I just talked about, Douglas, Grand Boulevard, and Washington Park in Chicago, were as segregated by skin color in 1950, 95%, as they are today, 99%. Yet the level of employment was much higher back then. So one has to account for the ways in which racial segregation interacts with other changes in society to produce the recent escalating rates of joblessness, neighborhood joblessness, and several factors stand out. The disappearance of work in many inner city neighborhoods is in part related to the nationwide decline in the fortunes of low-skilled workers. The sharp decline in the relative demand for unskilled labor has had a more adverse effect on blacks than on whites in the United States, because a substantially larger proportion of African Americans are unskilled. Now, although the number of skilled blacks, including managers, professionals, and technicians, has increased sharply in the last several years, the proportion of those who are unskilled remains large because the black population, burdened by the cumulative experiences of racial exclusion, was overwhelmingly unskilled just several decades ago. Now, the factors involved in the decreased relative demand for unskilled labor include the computer revolution, that is, the spread of new technologies that displaced low-skilled workers and rewarded the more highly trained, the rapid growth in college enrollment that increased the supply and reduced the relative cost of skilled labor, and the growing internationalization of economic activity, including trade liberalization policies, which reduced the price of imports and raised the output of export industries. Now, whereas the increased output of export industries aids skilled workers, simply because skilled workers are heavily represented in export industries, increasing imports, especially those from developing countries that compete with labor-intensive industries, for example, apparel, textile, toy, footwear, and some manufacturing industries, hurt unskilled labor, and therefore would have significant negative implications for American black workers. For example, 40% of the workforce in the apparel industry, hard hit by imports, is African Americans, 40%. But inner city workers in the United States face an additional problem: the growing suburbanization of jobs. Most ghetto residents cannot afford an automobile and therefore have to rely on public transit systems that make the connection between inner city neighborhoods and suburban job locations difficult and time consuming. Now, although the relative importance of the different underlying causes in the growing jobs problem of the less skilled continue to be debated, including the problems of experienced by inner city workers, there is little disagreement about the underlying trends. They are unlikely to reverse themselves. In short, over a sustained period, the labor market in the United States, like the labor market in Western Europe, has twisted against disadvantaged workers, those with limited skills or education, and or from poor families and neighborhoods, and therefore greatly diminished their actual and potential earnings. Changes in the class, racial, and demographic composition of inner city neighborhoods have also contributed to the high percentage of jobless adults in these neighborhoods. Because of the steady out-migration of more advantaged families, their proportion of non-poor families and prime-age working adults has decreased sharply in the typical inner city ghetto since 1970. And in the face of increasing and prolonged joblessness, the declining proportion of non-poor families and the overall depopulation have made it increasingly more difficult to sustain basic neighborhood institutions or to achieve adequate levels of social organization. The declining presence of working and middle-class blacks has also deprived these neighborhoods, these ghetto neighborhoods, of key resources, including structural resources such as residents with income to sustain neighborhood services, and cultural resources such as conventional role models for neighborhood children. On the basis of the research that we conducted in Chicago, it appears that what many of these high jobless neighborhoods have in common is a relatively high degree of social integration, that is, high levels of local neighboring, while being relatively isolated from contacts in the broader mainstream society, and low levels of informal social control, that is, feeling that they have little control over their immediate environment, including the environment's negative influences on their children. So in such areas, not only are children at risk because of the lack of informal social controls, they are also disadvantaged because the social interaction among neighbors tends to be confined to those whose skills, styles, orientations, and habits are not as conducive to promoting positive social outcomes like academic success, pro-social behavior, employment in the formal labor market, as are those in more stable neighborhoods. Now, although the close interaction among neighbors in such areas may be useful in devising strategies, disseminating information, developing styles of behavior that are helpful in a ghetto milieu, for example, teaching children to avoid eye-to-eye contact with strangers. You don't do that in the ghetto. Middle-class society, you're expected to make eye-to-eye contact. Or teaching children to develop a tough demeanor in the public sphere for self-protection. Now, these things may be helpful in a ghetto milieu, but they're less effective in promoting the welfare of children in the society at large. Now, despite being socially integrated, the residents in Chicago's ghetto neighborhoods share a feeling that they have little informal social control over the children in their environment. And a primary reason is the absence of a strong organizational capacity or an institutional resource base that would provide an extra layer of social organization in their neighborhoods. You know, when I'm addressing conservative audiences in the United States, I'm still able to reach conservative audiences. I just don't speak to members of the choir. When I address conservative audiences who constantly drive home how important it is to have family values, I make this point. It is easier for parents to control the behavior of the children in their neighborhoods when a strong institutional resource base exists, and when the links between community institutions such as churches, schools, political organizations, businesses, and civic clubs are strong and secure. The higher the density and stability of formal organizations, the less illicit activities such as drug trafficking and crime, prostitution, and the formation of gangs can take root in a neighborhood. A weak institutional resource base is what distinguishes high jobless inner city neighborhoods from stable middle class and working class areas. As one resident of a high jobless neighborhood in Chicago put it, quote, "Our children, you know, seems to be more at risk than any other children there is, because there's no library for them to go to, there's not a center they can go into, there's no field house they can go to, there's nothing at all," unquote. Parents in high jobless neighborhoods have a much more difficult task of controlling the behavior of their children, of their adolescents, or preventing them from getting involved in activities detrimental to pro-social development. And given the lack of organizational capacity and a weak institutional base, some parents choose to protect their children by isolating them from activities in the neighborhood, including the avoidance of contact and interaction with neighborhood families. And wherever possible, and often with great difficulty, when one considers the problems of transportation and limited financial resources, they attempt to establish contacts and cultivate relations with individuals, families, and institutions outside the neighborhood, such as church groups, schools, and community recreation programs. And as they try to keep their kids out of trouble, they often reach exhaustion. It is just as indefensible to treat inner city residents as superheroes who overcome racist oppression as it is to view them as helpless victims. We should, however, appreciate the range of choices, including choices representing cultural influences that are available to inner city residents who live under constraints that most people in the larger society do not experience. Now, in the eyes of employers in the metropolitan Chicago, the social conditions in the ghetto render inner city blacks less desirable as workers, and therefore many are reluctant to hire them. In one of the three studies that represented the empirical foundation for my book, When Work Disappears, included a representative sample of employers in the greater Chicago area who provided entry-level jobs. An overwhelming majority of these employers, both white and black, expressed negative views about inner-city ghetto workers, and many stated that they were reluctant to hire them. For example, a president of an inner-city manufacturing firm expressed a concern about employing residents from certain inner-city neighborhoods. Quote, if somebody gave me their address, Cabrini Green, which, by the way, was a large housing project in Chicago recently torn down. If somebody gave me their address, Cabrini Green, I might unavoidably have some concerns. Interviewer, what would your concerns be? Respondent, that the poor guy probably would be frequently unable to get to work, and I probably would watch him more carefully, even if it wasn't fair, than I would with somebody else. I know what I should do, though, is recognize that here's a guy that is trying to get out of his situation and probably will work harder than anybody else who's already out there, and he might be the best one around here. But I think I would have to struggle. I think I would have to struggle accepting that premise at the beginning, unquote. Now, in addition to qualms about the neighborhood milieu of inner city residents, the employers frequently mentioned concerns about applicants' language skills and educational training. An employer from a computer software firm in Chicago expressed the view, quote, that in many businesses, the ability to meet the public is paramount, and you do not talk street talk to the buying public. Almost all your black welfare people talk street talk. And who's going to sit them down and change their speech patterns, unquote. A Chicago real estate broker made a similar point, quote, a lot of times I will interview applicants who are black, who are sort of lower class. They'll come to me and I cannot hire them because their language skills are so poor. Their speaking voice, for one thing, is poor. They have no verbal facility with the language. And these, you know, they just don't know how to speak. And they'll say salesmen's instead of salesmen. And that's a problem. They don't know punctuation, they don't know how to use correct grammar, and they cannot spell, and I can't hire them. And I feel bad about that. And I think they're being very disadvantaged by the Chicago public school system. Another respondent defended his method of screening out most job applicants on the telephone on the basis of their use of, quote, grammar and English, unquote. I have every right to say that that's a requirement for this job. I don't care if you're pink, black, green, or yellow. No. I don't care if you're pink, black, green, yellow, or orange. I demand someone who speaks well. You want to tell me that I'm a bigot? Fine, call me a bigot. I know blacks. You don't even know they're black. So do you, unquote. And finally, an inner city banker claimed that many blacks in the ghetto, quote, simply cannot read. When you're talking our type of business, that disqualifies them immediately. We don't have a job here that doesn't require that somebody have minimum reading and writing skills, unquote. Now, how should we interpret the negative attitudes and actions of employers? To what extent do they represent an aversion to blacks per se? And to what degree do they reflect judgments based on the job-related skills and training of inner-city blacks in a changing labor market? Now, I should point out that the statements made by the African-American employers we interviewed concerning the qualifications of inner-city black workers did not differ significantly from those of the white employers. The basic difference is that the African-American employers were a little bit more sophisticated in explaining why they didn't want to hire the inner-city workers. Whereas 74%, they would focus, for example, on the nefarious and deleterious effects of the inner city environment and the terrible schools these kids are in. Whereas 74% of the white employers who responded to the open-ended questions expressed negative views of the job-related traits of inner city blacks, 80% of the black employers did so as well. So this raises a question about the meaning and significance of race in certain situations. In other words, how race intersects with other factors. And a key hypothesis in this connection is that given the recent shifts in the economy, employers are looking for workers with a broad range of abilities, hard skills, quote unquote, literacy, numeracy, basic mechanical ability, and other testable attributes, and quote, soft unquote skills, personality suitable to the work environment. You know, I'm going into one of these chain stores in Chicago, and there's this young woman standing on her feet 8 hours. I come in at 5 o'clock, and she's still smiling at me, have a good day. Personality suitable to the work environment, good grooming, group-oriented work behaviors. Now, while hard skills are the product of education and training, benefits that are apparently in short supply in inner-city schools, soft skills are strongly tied to culture and are therefore shaped in this connection by the harsh environment of the inner-city ghetto. I already mentioned in our research that many parents in the inner city ghettos of Chicago warned their kids not to make eye-to-eye contact and to develop a tough demeanor when interacting with people. That might serve them well in the ghetto, but when they're interacting with middle-class blacks and whites outside the ghetto, it turns them off, the middle class. Now, if employers are indeed reacting to the differences in skills or perceived differences in skills between white and black applicants, it becomes increasingly difficult to discuss the motives of employers. Are they rejecting inner city blacks out of overt racial discrimination or on the basis of qualifications? Nonetheless, many of the selective recruitment practices do represent what economists call statistical discrimination. That is, employers make assumptions about the inner city black workers in general and reach decisions based on those assumptions before they've had a chance to review systematically the qualifications of an individual applicant. And the net effect is that many black inner city applicants are never given the chance to prove their qualifications on an individual level because they are systematically screened out by the selective recruitment process. Statistical discrimination, although representing elements of class bias against poor workers in the inner city, is clearly a matter of race. The selective recruitment patterns effectively screen out far more black workers from the inner city, our research reveals, than Hispanic or white workers from the same types of backgrounds. But race is also a factor even in those decisions to deny employment to inner city black workers on the basis of objective and thorough evaluations of their qualifications. The hard and soft skills among inner city blacks that do not match the current needs of the labor market are products of racially restricted, racially segregated communities, communities that have historically featured social constraints and restricted opportunities. Thus, the job prospects of inner city workers have diminished in recent years, not only because of the decreased relative demand for low-skilled labor in the United States economy, not only because of the suburbanization of jobs, not only because of the social deterioration of ghetto neighborhoods, but also because of negative employer attitudes. For all these reasons, the passage of the recent welfare reform bill, I don't want to talk much about this because I'm giving another lecture on the 6th on this topic, but for all these reasons, the passage of the recent welfare reform bill, which did not include a program of job creation, could have very negative social consequences in the inner city. Unless something is done to enhance the employment opportunities of inner city welfare recipients who reach the time limit for the receipt of welfare, if the economy turns sour, they will flood a pool that will already be filled with low-skilled jobless workers. New research into urban labor markets by the economist Harry Holzer of Michigan State University reveals the magnitude of the problem. Surveying 3,000 employers in Atlanta, Boston, Detroit, and Los Angeles, Holzer found that only 5 to 10% of the jobs in central city areas for workers who are non-college graduates require very few work credentials or cognitive skills. This means that most inner city workers today not only need to have the basic skills of reading, writing, and performing arithmetic calculations, but need to know how to operate a computer as well. Also, most employers require a high school degree, particular kinds of previous work experience, and job references. And because of the large oversupply of low-skilled workers relative to the number of low-skilled jobs, many low-educated and poorly trained individuals have difficulty finding jobs even when the local labor market is strong. You see, the problem is this. In recent years, tight labor markets, that is, periods of low unemployment in the United States, have been of relatively short duration, frequently followed by a recession, which either wiped out previous gains for many workers or did not allow others to recover from a previous period of economic stagnation. It would take sustained tight labor markets over many years to draw back those discouraged inner city workers who have dropped out of the labor market altogether, some for very long periods of time. The United States is now in one of the longest economic recoveries in the last half century, a recovery that has lasted about 8 years and generated more than 14 million net new jobs and the lowest official unemployment rate in 24 years. Now, this sustained recovery is beginning to have some positive effect on the hardcore unemployed. The ranks of those out of work for more than 6 months declined by almost 150,000 over a two-month period in early 1997. I didn't have time to get more recent data, but I'm sure it's higher now. And as reported several months ago, since 1992, the unemployment rate for high school dropouts declined by 5 points from 12 to 7%, and two-fifths of this decline had come in the last year. How long this economic recovery period will last is anybody's guess. Some economists feel that it will last for at least several more years. You agree, John?
Okay, my economist friend here from the States.
If it does, if it lasts for several more years, it will be the best antidote, the best medicine for low-skilled workers whose employment and earnings prospects have diminished in the late 20th century. For example, in America's inner cities, the extension of the economic recovery for several more years will significantly lower the overall jobless rate, not only for the low-skilled workers who are still in the labor force, but also for those who have been outside the labor market for many years as well. It will also enhance the job prospects for many of the welfare recipients who reach the time limit for the receipt of welfare. But given the decreased relative demand for low-skilled labor, what will happen to all of these groups if the economy slows down? And considering the changing nature of the economy, there is little reason to assume that their prospects will be anything but bleak. Why? Simply because the economic trend that has twisted against low-skilled workers is unlikely to reverse itself, as I said before, thereby diminishing over the long term their job prospects and earnings. The growing problems facing low-skilled workers are not unique to the United States, however. With changes in technology and the globalization of the economy, knowledge-based industries are growing more rapidly than other industries in the economies of Western nations. While many educated workers benefit from these changes, the demand for low-skilled workers has plummeted to the lowest depths in human history. As I have pointed out, in the United States, the decreased demand for low-skilled labor has elevated jobless rates in the inner cities. Furthermore, in both the United States and Britain, it has resulted in growing wage differentials between the economic haves and have-nots. Outside of Britain, in most continental Europe, wage inequality has grown more slowly because of more powerful trade unions and a thicker social safety net, but the decreased demand for low-skilled labor has shown up in higher levels, double-digit, in most cases, unemployment. The sharp decline in the relative demand for low-skilled labor has had a more adverse effect on minorities, including immigrant minorities in Europe, because a substantially larger proportion are unskilled. And as their jobless rates and related social dislocations rise, will the policy discussions to address the jobs problems focus on matters pertaining to race instead of those involving class? A brief look at recent developments in the United States may suggest an answer. National and international economic transformations have placed new stresses on families and communities in the United States, stresses that are hardly confined to blacks. Along with African Americans, large segments of the white, Latino, Asian, and Native American populations have also been plagued by economic insecurities, family breakups, community stresses. Such conditions are breeding grounds for racial and ethnic tensions. Now, in this social climate, some conservatives in the States have attempted to unite white Americans around anger at the government and racial minorities. Their political messages seem plausible to many white taxpayers who see themselves as being forced to pay for programs such as welfare for the jobless poor that are perceived as benefiting primarily racial minorities. Now, why have such messages resonated with many in the white population during the 1990s, especially the first half of the 1990s? Well, the typical liberal response to this question is that these messages are effective because they trigger underlying feelings of American racism. Accordingly, many American liberals are pessimistic about public policy initiatives to address the inner city jobs problems. And when I go around, I lecture a lot in the United States, and I meet a lot of grassroots organizations that are out there bridging the divide and pulling groups together to effect change. And I talk to my liberals back in academia, and they look at me like I'm crazy. They're very pessimistic. Racism is just too much to overcome, they say. Racism, a term often used to explain the conditions of racial minorities in the United States, especially the conditions of African Americans, should be understood as an ideology of racial domination or exploitation that features two things. One, beliefs that a particular racial group is either biogenetically or culturally inferior to the dominant group. And two, the use of such beliefs to justify the way the designated racial group is treated or ought to be treated by the members of society as well as the institutions of the larger society. Now, feelings about how the group is treated or ought to be treated can range from the most extreme view that they should be denied the same rights and privileges available to the dominant group to the milder view, the milder form of opposing or resisting certain steps or certain programs to alleviate the stress or enhance the status of the racial group. Now, whether the view proposed represents either the more extreme form or the milder form, it is racist only if it is based on beliefs that the racial group is biologically or culturally inferior. Now, in the United States, there is no question that the most extreme forms of racist ideology have declined significantly. Unlike in Jim Crow segregation era from the late 1890s to shortly before mid-20th century, hardly anyone today is willing to endorse categorical beliefs in the biological inferiority of African Americans as a justification for denying them equal rights. Hardly anyone would endorse that position. Nor will you find more than a small minority of Americans willing to endorse statements that racial minorities should be denied equal rights and privileges because of inferior cultural traits. Racial ideology still prevails, however. In recent years, a general social survey conducted by the National Opinion Research Center of the University of Chicago changed the questionnaire format it had been using since 1940 to gauge racial stereotypes. Instead of asking respondents to agree or disagree with blunt categorical assertions, respondents were asked to rate blacks, whites, Hispanics, and Asians using bipolar rating scales. Thus, African Americans were compared with other ethnic groups in terms of the work ethic, preference for welfare, and degree of intelligence. Now, these relative, as opposed to categorical judgments, revealed that blacks are rated less intelligent than whites, more violence prone, lazier, less patriotic, more likely to prefer living off welfare than whites. And not only are whites rated more favorably than blacks, but on four of the five traits examined, except patriotism, many whites rated the majority of blacks as possessing negative qualities and a majority of whites as possessing positive qualities. The data I'm presenting is based on research conducted by my colleague at Harvard, Larry Bobo. Nonetheless, despite these negative stereotypes over the past 50 years, there has been a steep decline in white support for racial segregation and discrimination. For example, although in 1942, only 42% of white Americans supported integrated schooling, 42%, by 1993, that figure had skyrocketed to 95%. Public opinion polls reveal similar patterns of change during the last five decades in white support for the integration of public accommodations and mass transportation and the principle of integrated residential areas. Nonetheless, the virtual disappearance of Jim Crow attitudes in support of racial segregation has not resulted in strong backing for government, I underline government programs, to aggressively combat discrimination, increase integration, enroll blacks in institutions of higher learning, or enlarge the proportion of blacks in higher level occupations. Indeed, as evidenced in the public opinion polls, whites overwhelmingly object to government assistance targeted to blacks. For example, support for the principle of equal access to jobs stood at 97% in 1972. 97% of all whites supported equal access to jobs. So many people agreed with that statement that they dropped it. Didn't ask it after 1972. But in 1972, support for federal efforts to prevent job discrimination, however, had only reached 39%. Whereas 8 out of every 10 African Americans today believe that the government is not spending enough to assist blacks today, only slightly more than one-third of white Americans feel this way. The idea that the federal government has a special obligation to help improve the living standard of blacks because they have been discriminated against so long was supported by only 1 in 5 whites in 1991 and has never exceeded more than 1 in 4 since 1975. And the lack of white support for government programs in support of blacks is unrelated to background factors such as age and education level. Now, I put this question to you. How much of this opposition to government programs can be attributed to stereotypes about black cultural traits? In other words, how much of the opposition represents the milder form of cultural racism? In this connection, a recent study of trends in white explanations of black-white of the black-white economic gap revealed that throughout the period of 1977 to 1989, the most frequently stated reason for the economic gap between blacks and whites was a lack of motivation on the part of African Americans. In other words, African Americans are blamed for their own poorer economic position. And this prevalent denial of social responsibility and the high level of negative stereotyping as reflected in the recent general social surveys suggests, as my colleague Larry Bobo pointed out, that for many white Americans, blacks are viewed as undeserving of special treatment from the government. Conservative supporters of welfare reform implicitly communicated this message in their explanations of the high jobless and public assistance rates in the inner city and in their opposition to affirmative action programs. Thus, when American conservatives like Charles Murray tried to account for the high welfare rates of the jobless inner city poor, they maintain that these rates reflect the shortcomings of individuals, including their lack of work ethic. There is little or no appreciation for the harmful behavioral effects that emerge when lack of job opportunities results in persistent joblessness. And this is not a problem unique to inner city blacks. I'd just like to point this out parenthetically. One of the earliest studies to examine the effects of persistent unemployment was conducted over 50 years ago by Marie Jehoda, Paul Lazarsfeld, and Hans Zeisel in Marienthal, Austria, a small industrial community in Austria. At the time of the study, there was a worldwide depression that was much worse in Marienthal than anything the United States or Britain went through. Now, during the period of the research, the entire community of Marienthal was unemployed. And one of the main theses of the Marienthal study was that prolonged unemployment leads to a state of apathy in which the victims do not utilize any longer even the few opportunities left to them. Now, before this economic depression, when people in the community were working, political organizations were active. People of the town read a lot, entered eagerly into discussions, and enjoyed organizing a variety of events. Their lives were organized around the factory. Their lives were organized around work. The factory was at the center of this lively community. It was not simply a place of work. It was a center of social life. All of this disappeared when the factory was shut down. Describing the situation during their field research in the 1930s, the author stated, quote, "Cut off from their work and deprived of contact with the outside world, the workers of Marienthal have lost the material and moral incentives to make use of their time. Now that they are no longer under any pressure, they undertake nothing new and drift gradually out of an ordered existence into one that is undisciplined and empty. Looking back over any period of this free time, they are unable to recall anything worth mentioning. For hours on end, the men stand around in the street alone or in small groups leaning against a wall or a house. When a vehicle drives through the village, they turn their heads slightly. Several of them smoke pipes. They carry on leisurely conversations for which they have unlimited time. Nothing is urgent anymore. They have forgotten how to hurry." Unquote. It's not the inner city ghetto. It's a white small town in Austria. The idleness, lack of discipline due to persistent joblessness in Marienthal is not unlike the idleness and undisciplined behavior associated with persistent joblessness in today's inner city neighborhoods. But these are issues. These are not issues that the cultural racists highlight when they argue against government programs to aid the jobless poor. However, I maintain that it would be a mistake to focus on this new form of racism, however widely endorsed, when discussing the willingness of Americans to address the jobs problem in the inner city. Why? Simply because we need to consider, for social policy purposes, the extent to which situational economic and political factors mediate the effects of racial ideology. Allow me to briefly comment on this. The degree of support for social policies to address inequality is in no small measure related to feelings of economic anxiety. Take the situation in the United States from 1990 to 1995. The period in which the country was still staggering from the effects of the 1990-1992 economic recession. The decline of real wages, that is, wages adjusted for inflation, that had begun in the early 1973, continued uninterrupted during the first half of the 1990s. Working class Americans felt economically pinched, barely able to maintain current standards of living even on two incomes. 10 million workers held two or more jobs in 1995 in the States, a figure that had increased 70% since 1980. Indeed, in 6 million households, two adults hold four jobs to make ends meet. By 1995, the time on the job for the average worker had increased 163 hours a year since 1980, or roughly an extra month a year. Work time has risen for a great majority of employed Americans, not only Wall Street lawyers, but hospital orderlies and assembly line workers as well. Many were insecure about keeping their jobs. For example, a 1994 nationwide poll revealed that 40% of the workers in America worried that they might be laid off or have their wages reduced. Many feared that they will never be able to afford to send their children to college. Many believed that for all their hard work, their children's lives would be worse than theirs. For example, a 1995 Harris poll conducted for Business Week revealed that only half of all parents expected their children to have a better life than theirs. Nearly 7 out of 10 believed that the American dream had been more difficult to achieve during the past 10 years, and 3/4 felt that the dream would be even harder to achieve during the next 10 years. This economic anxiety, evident during the first half of the 1990s, lingers on during the more robust economic period today, albeit in reduced form. And because it lingers on, it perhaps explains why there has been so much worker restraint during the mid to late 1990s in the face of a prolonged economic recovery. Now, as I indicated previously, since 1993, the U.S. economy has added roughly 14 million jobs, and the unemployment rate has declined below 4.5%, the lowest since 1973. Yet prices have not increased very much. You guys follow the debate in the United States about the policies of the Federal Reserve Board, always trying to control unemployment by raising interest rates. You have low unemployment, they raise interest rates because they're afraid that low unemployment is going to trigger inflation. And so workers get happy, we got low unemployment, and then the Federal Reserve Board says, uh-oh, inflation is going to affect the bond market. Boom. Raise interest rates and unemployment soars. All of a sudden, they're holding back because the usual connection between high employment and high inflation is no longer there. Despite the strong economic recovery, prices have not increased very much because wages, the main element of costs, have not increased much either. Despite high levels of employment and labor shortages in some areas, workers have been surprisingly hesitant to demand higher wages. Now, few would have predicted that kind of behavior in such a favorable job market. As the MIT economist Paul Krugman recently pointed out, apparently the recession and initially jobless recovery left a deep mark on the national psyche. Workers' confidence has been shaken by downsizing, and the specter, real or imagined, that many of their jobs can be done for a fraction of their salaries by workers in third world countries. In a recent survey of a random sample of the American public, 68% of the respondents overall and 72% of the non-college graduates expressed concern about the sending of jobs overseas by American companies. Commenting on this finding, the Princeton economist Alan Krueger states, quote, "The fact the public is so scared of globalization may mean that wage results have been moderated as a result," unquote. Workers in the United States feel they can't rely on weak unions to bargain effectively for higher wages, and if they lose their jobs, they feel compelled to take other employment soon on whatever terms they can get. So with such a nervous and timid workforce, states the economist Klugman, the economy can gallop along for a while without setting in motion a wage-price spiral. And so we are left with a paradox. We have more or less full employment only because individual workers do not feel secure in their jobs. The secret of our success is not productivity, but anxiety, unquote. Well, unfortunately, during periods when people are beset with economic anxiety, they become receptive to simplistic ideological messages that deflect attention from the real and complex sources of their problems. And it is vitally important that political leaders channel frustrations in more positive or constructive directions. But during the 1990s, a period of heightened economic anxiety, just the opposite frequently occurred. The poisonous rhetoric of certain highly visible spokespersons increased ethnic tensions and channeled frustrations in ways that divide groups in America. Instead of associating citizens' problems with economic and political changes, these divisive messages encouraged them to turn on each other, race against race, citizens against immigrants, ethnic group against ethnic group. We must understand, as I stated before, that ethnic and racial antagonisms are products of situations, economic situations, political situations, social situations. Average citizens do not fully understand these complex forces. They are looking for answers as they cope with their own anxieties. Unfortunately, the most persuasive and powerful answers, as far as the public is concerned, recently have come not from progressives, who are more likely to associate the problems of these citizens with the complex changes of the late 20th century, rather they have come from conservative spokespersons with effective soundbite messages that deflect attention from the real source of our problems, including messages that blame inner city residents themselves for their high jobless and welfare rates. And these messages rang loud and clear in 1994 and 1995. Especially in the months leading up to and following the congressional elections of 1994, when conservative Republicans took over the U.S. Congress. However, in the last 2 years, I'm happy to report, the frequency and intensity of these messages have noticeably decreased. And I think that we can thank continued improvement in the economy for that. People are still economically anxious and are still worried about their future, but public opinion polls reveal that they are more satisfied with the state of affairs today than they were in 1994 when the Republicans took over the United States Congress, and in 1995 when conservative political leaders perceived that their messages about the adverse effects of welfare, immigration, and affirmative action would resonate with the general population. Is now the time for progressives to build on this shift in the public mood? I think so. I am convinced that despite the new form of cultural racism, we can create a climate in the United States that could lead to a constructive dialogue on how problems associated with the disappearance of work among certain segments of our population can be addressed. It is important to appreciate, first of all, that the poor and the working classes of all racial and ethnic groups struggle to make ends meet and that even the middle class has experienced a decline in its living standard. Now, these groups make up about 80% of the American population, and unlike the top 20%, they are struggling. Indeed, despite improvements in the economy, these Americans representing different racial and ethnic groups continue to worry about unemployment and job security, declining real wages, escalating medical and housing costs, the availability of affordable child care programs, the sharp decline in the quality of public education, and crime and drug trafficking in their neighborhoods. Now, despite being officially race neutral, programs created in response to these concerns, programs that increase employment opportunities and job skill training, improve public education, promote better child and health care, and reduce neighborhood crime and drug abuse would disproportionately benefit the inner city poor, but they would also benefit large segments of the remaining population, including the white population as well. National opinion polls results suggest the possibility of a new alignment in support of a comprehensive social rights initiative in the United States that would include such programs. And if such an alignment is attempted, perhaps it ought to feature a new public rhetoric that would do two things. One, focus on problems that afflict not only the jobless poor, but also the working and middle classes as well. And two, emphasize integrative programs, what you people here would call programs of social inclusion, that would promote the social and economic improvement of all groups in society in need of help, not just the truly disadvantaged jobless segments of the population. Groups ranging from the inner city poor to working and middle class Americans who are struggling to make ends meet will have to be effectively mobilized in order to change the current course taken by policymakers in America. And you know, there is a growing awareness in America that perhaps the best way to accomplish this is through coalition politics. And because an effective political coalition in the part depends upon how the issues to be addressed are defined, I want to repeat that it is imperative that the political message underscore the need for economic and social reform that benefits all groups in need of help, not just America's minority poor. And the framers of this message should be cognizant of the fact that changes in the global economy have increased social inequality and created situations which had enhanced antagonisms between different racial and ethnic groups, and that these groups, although often seen as adversaries, are potential allies in a reform coalition because they suffer from a common problem, economic distress caused by forces outside their own control. If inner city blacks are experiencing the greatest problems of joblessness in the United States, it is a more extreme form of economic marginality that has affected most low-skilled workers in America since 1980. Unfortunately, there is a tendency among policymakers, black leaders, and scholars alike to separate the economic problems of the ghetto from the national and international trends affecting American families and neighborhoods. If the economic problems of the ghetto are defined solely in racial terms, they can be isolated and viewed as only requiring race-based solutions, as proposed by those on the left, or narrow political solutions with subtle racial connotations, such as welfare reform, as strongly endorsed by those on the right. Race continues to be a factor that aggravates inner-city black employment problems, but the tendency to overemphasize the racial factors obscures more fundamental forces that have sharply increased inner-city black joblessness. As the late black economist Vivian Henderson put it several years ago, quote, "It is as if racism, having put blacks in an economic place, stepped aside to watch changes in the economy destroy that place," unquote. To repeat, the concentrated joblessness of the inner-city poor represents the most dramatic form of the growing economic dislocations affecting many Americans that stem in large measure from changes in the organization of the economy, including the global economy. I end with this point. My reflections on the scene in America lead me to the conclusion that as Britain and other nations in Europe confront the problems of urban poverty and joblessness in the global economy, they ought to appreciate that discussions that emphasize common solutions to commonly shared problems promote a sense of unity regardless of the different degrees of severity in the problems afflicting different groups. Such messages bring ethnic and racial groups together, not apart, and are especially important during periods of ethnic and racial tension. And because the problems of the new social inequality, the gap between the expanding have-nots and the haves, are growing more severe, a vision that acknowledges racially distinct problems and the need for remedies like affirmative action to address the underrepresentation of minorities in value positions, but at the same time emphasizes the importance of transracial solutions to shared problems, is more important now than ever. Such a vision should be developed, shared, and promoted by all progressive leaders, but especially by political leaders. A new democratic vision is needed. A new vision, democratic vision, which would reject the commonly held view that race or ethnic identity is so divisive that groups from different nations and ethnic backgrounds cannot work together in a common cause. Those articulating the new vision must realize that if a political message is tailored to a white audience, racial minorities draw back, just as whites draw back when a message is tailored to minority audiences. The challenge is to find issues and programs that concern the families of all racial and ethnic groups so that individuals in these groups can honestly perceive their mutual interests and join in a multi-ethnic coalition to move a country forward. Thank you very much.
Could I just mention that there is a reception on the fifth floor in the senior common room to which everyone here is invited. Since we've run a little over time, I think we'll have to go directly to that rather than have questions here. So anyone who wants to talk to Professor Wilson, please come to the reception and buttonhole him individually. Let me just ask you to thank him again for his inspiring lecture.